Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and we are going to spend the next couple of hours talking about books that would make great holiday presents this year. And who other than Daniel Golden, back with us once again. I always look forward to his visits. He owns Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee. And he comes along to share a list of books a couple times a year at least. And this list includes novels, mysteries, a children's book, histories, something for everybody, and maybe a book that you might want to purchase yourself. We're going to talk at 12:30, zero in a bit more on children's books with our guest from the Cooperative Children's Book Center, the CCBC at UW-Madison. But first, you want a recommendation for a book from Daniel, or give us your book recommendations? Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Daniel Golden, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Welcome back. I'm glad it's warm in the studio.
You got a big pile of books here, too.
I would not warm myself up with the books, because that sounds bad. So
what do you think of this year's crop, I guess we could say, of books?
Every year there's so much stuff, and a lot of it is just kind of funneling through things, lots of surprises, I do think that what's interesting to me is that some of the longtime names aren't around as much. Mm-hmm. People write slower. People's careers fade. We were talking about what maybe is the book of the year. It feels like, you know, in terms of literary books of the year, it would be James, which is on my list. It is, if folks don't know the book, it is a retelling of Huckleberry Finn through the eyes of James or Jim. And it has been probably gotten the best reviews of the year. It's been on all the awards shortlists. What's always interesting to me about awards is it's a small pool of judges, 3 to 5 people usually, who make the decisions on these awards. And they have to decide, are they going to crown the obvious choice, or are they going to pick somebody out of more oblivion and break them out? And I feel like for the last few years, we've been seeing more of the latter. Picking the obvious choice is old school, but James is so powerful that it has won the National Book Award. It won the Kirkus Prize. It just got named to the top 10 books of the year by the Washington Post. And I think the New York Times one came out yesterday or today. The only big prize so far it hasn't won is the Booker Prize. They picked that book Orbital, which I haven't read yet, but is doing pretty well, about a group of people on a space station. So that group said, you know, either they had someone who didn't like it. I know people who haven't liked James, but most of the time, most of the time, it's probably just they wanted to pick something more obscure to create a career for this, a bigger career, take them to the next step.
So how are things going with independent bookstores?
At first COVID was tough, and then there was the publishing industry in general, 2021, 22 had a big burst of energy and sales increases. That's fallen back a bit, but it did lead to large numbers of increases in bookstores in the country in the last 10 years. I think partly the news media, who had been very anti-bookstore in the aughts and early teens, became very pro-bookstore. They looked at the models and said, you know, these are small businesses are surviving and they're doing pretty well. And so every market, Madison, Milwaukee, lots of all over Wisconsin is getting new bookstores. New bookstores opening faster than bookstores can close. You want a net plus.
Yeah. This is kind of a sad story today. Paul's bookstore in Madison is closing. The lady who owns it, I think Paul's wife, a widow, is 94.
Yeah.
And so they're doing great.
Yeah. You know, that Oak Park bookstore just closed like that as well. That was a new and bargain bookstore. And sometimes they could have sold the store, but there's might be a lease issue because that happens a lot mm-hmm. in a market like Madison where the leases are probably pretty expensive. And sometimes the bookstore becomes very personal to the owners and they don't really want to pass it on. And of course, sometimes they can't. For something like with Paul's, if the store was doing really well, I think that was probably her decision or maybe the landlord's decision.
Yeah.
But secondhand bookstores have an extra problem because they also still have the browsing. But just like new bookstores, so much of that business has gone online. It makes it a little tougher. And it's really made it difficult for like the antiquarian part of the market. We have constantly have people asking us to price their old books. We don't do that business. We don't have anybody in Milwaukee that really actively prices antiquarian books.
Oh.
And so, and I'm not going to put a $1,000 book in the store. I'll get, you know, it'll get damaged if at best.
Absolutely. Well, still the independents, I love going into independent stores because I love talking with the people who work there. I mean, that's such a to engage with those folks.
You know, bookstores in general, in person, as opposed to I'm saying even, you know, like you can go to pretty much any Barnes & Noble and start talking to somebody and they will also have a lot of interesting things to say, but you get lots of people making the decisions also. So if you go to a bookstore in Sheboygan or Door County or Wausau, they're reading their own books and they're telling each other about their own books and they're finding local books that they like. And, you know, there's so much discovery involved because every store displays the books differently.
Yeah.
We don't really have a strong co-op model. You know how you go to a supermarket and you go to different chains and they still have all the stuff in the same places?
Yeah.
And you're like, where's something interesting? And I mean, there are exceptions to that. So, but yeah, that's why I like it too. And we've talked before about some of your favorite bookstores. So,
yeah, well, you know, you mentioned James as probably the top book of the year in many ways. Let's take a nonfiction book once. And one on your list, AI Snake Oil, What Artificial Intelligence Can Do What It Can't and How to Tell the Difference, by Arvind Narayanan.
Yes, two authors.
And Sesha Kapoor.
So two authors. We'll get the AI to tell us the exact pronunciation. Both the authors were on Time Magazine's top AI influencers of 2023. This is a book that, you know, when people say, you read that? And I was like, well, I'm very interested in AI. It's everywhere. And there are a lot of books on it. And I really needed something to make sense of it. I also like to read a few University Press books a year. This one's from Princeton University Press. And what I liked about it is it was very, you know, so much of what I read in newspapers is really, in a sense, and magazine articles or online articles, from legacy magazines is it's a lot of marketing, you know, that the whole idea of getting AI out there is to get people to invest in it, to build demand and get people to invest. So we get a lot of misinformation about it. For one thing, there's really lots of different kinds of technologies that form AI and we group them all together. And a lot of it has been in existence for a long time, you know. So if you have a text and it self-corrects, that's AI.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
And but there are two basic kinds of AI in the book, generative AI and predictive AI. And the authors look at both kinds of AI, and they basically say one works with caveats, and that's the generative, mm-hmm. and the predictive AI is the one that you should kind of do a slant eye at, that it's as hard for AI to predict things as anything. Anybody who plays the stock market or gambles knows that you can't completely use the past to predict the future.
Yeah.
So I really enjoyed it. It was very readable, like for an academic book. I found it very engaging. And I think it's, you know, for a lot of people either beginning to use it or contemplating using it or already using it, I think they get a lot out of it.
Let's take another nonfiction, Cat, or Catland.
Woohoo! Catland! Meow! So I will...
Lewis Wayne?
Lewis Wayne's book. So the author is named Catherine Hughes, and this has a caveat, which is, or a preface, that I actually read a book called Dogland this spring that I may have talked about in June that was about... the domestication of dogs, dog breeding, dog shows. And at the through line on that book was following a trainer who wanted to have the first Samoyed to win the best in show. And one of the funniest sides in that book was the rise of pugs. And if you follow the Westminster show, a pug just won for the first time. So Catland is very similar in terms of that, if you substitute, you know, much like our store has 80% of our cards are dogs and cats. So people are interested, but it's a little different. For one thing, the journey from feral creature to fuzzy feline was a little more dramatic than it was for dogs. People don't know as much about cat breeding, and they don't know as much about cat shows. And one of the thing that's interesting about it to me is while people do use shelters for both dogs and cats, there's still a much stronger market for purebred dogs than there is for purebred cats. We don't know about it, but it's there. But the best part of this book, the most interesting thing is the through line is this story of Lewis Wayne, as you mentioned, who is this illustrator of cat paintings for about 50 years, and you know them. They're anthropomorphic, and the cats are like delivering mail and having a party and getting drunk at a bar and, you know, having a food spill at a dinner. And they were like all over Christmas cards and things. His story is fascinating because he never licensed. He sold these prints. So he was in abject poverty his whole life. He married early. She died. He took care of his mother and all his unmarried siblings. He never really found peace until he actually wound up living the last years of his life in an asylum, which is when his paintings became popular in museums. Because they were like, they're kind of pop art. If somebody wants to, somebody should just go online and look at the cover. But this is, the museum paintings were crazy. I thought this book was so interesting. I'm not an animal person. I'm allergic. Animals love me. And I am kind of generous to them. So I did give the book after I read it and liked it. I gave it to my sister, who's had as many as 4 cats at a time. And she loved it, too. So it's Cat Lover Tested.
By Catherine Hughes.
Yes.
Oh, man. Well, I have 2 cats at home. So that's one that I will have to take a look at.
It's beautiful, too. It's nicely priced. It's got full color plates. Look at that.
Oh,
nobody
yeah.
can see it. They can look online. Look up Lewis Wayne. There's also a documentary on Prime about Lewis Wayne, too, which people say is very good.
Our guest today, Daniel Golden, owner of Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee. He's got a list for us of 20 books that he's suggesting for the holiday season for a gift for a friend or a gift for yourself. I like to gift myself quite a bit when it comes to books, especially. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at books for the holiday season with Daniel Golden of Boswell Book Company. And by the way, he has a list of 20 books, and we will have that list posted on the Larry Mueller Show page by 2 o'clock today. I think it always around 2 is when we post the list. So you'll be able to take a look at it, at the full list, at 2 or after today. Well, Daniel, I want to go back to fiction. The Great Divide is the next book on your list for fiction. Christina Enrique.
Yes. It's historic. I always like to have a couple of historical novels. Done with some research. It is about the building of the Panama Canal, Great Divide. It follows, it is a little more period fiction because it just have more made up characters. So she tried to kind of follow people who normally aren't highlighted in histories. So that would be the workers on the canal, many of whom came from Barbados because they spoke English, which the Panamanians did not. The story also follows several people working on the canal, as well as people in the villages whose homes were going to be flooded, because we have to remember that. I remember that a lot with China's river projects, you know, people's, and even in the United States as well. And then one, at least, historical figure whose name is John Oswald. I think I wrote the wrong name there, who was a scientist who was brought in to wipe out malaria. And the scientists had done such a good job of getting rid of yellow fever that they thought they could use the same tools to get rid of it was a lot more complicated. The story is told through him and also his wife, who is brought to I'm not going to give anything away, but somebody gets sick. Anyway, it's sort of like a tapestry of different voices. Her last book, which was called it was about all the people who lived in an apartment building. It was called The Book of Unknown Americans. And this is very similar in setup. I will note a lot of high schools read The Book of Unknown Americans. And like that, this story has two young people at the center who have fall in love. It is very teen friendly. Like, it's a nice book. It crosses over to young adults. Except it does have adults, too, which sometimes you don't get it. It's not a young adult book. It is definitely an adult book. But it is a wonderfully written. It's a Read with Jenna. I happen to read a lot of Read with Jenna picks. I don't know their Read with Jenna picks when I read them. So we're obviously we obviously have some overlapping taste there.
Well, back to the Panama Canal book for just a minute, only because this morning there was an article in the Wisconsin State Journal that related to the lead mechanical and electrical engineer for the Panama Canal project studied here at the UW-Madison. And the only reason it came up was because they're thinking of raising the house where he lived.
Maybe it'll become a museum or something. Maybe they'll tow it somewhere else. I've got a lot of ideas.
Well, how about, let's go back to another nonfiction. Guilty Pleasure, Creatures, Sex, God, and Murder in Tallahassee, Florida by Makita Brotman.
Well, the thing about Guilty Creatures is that I didn't realize that I really like true crime. Sometimes I say the current bookstore, independent bookstore, is a lot like the B. Dalton of the 1970s. Like, a lot of the genres that were really popular then with mass markets have become popular. Romance, fantasy, science fiction, horror, big horror sections everywhere, and true crime. And I would say I dabble, as you'll know from the list, I dabble in some of these genres. They're usually crossover. They're not hardcore. But after dabbling in like authors like Patrick Radden Keefe and David Gran, who are kind of like, they're basically new true crime, but they're New Yorker writers and they've got issues and they're sophisticated and the writing's great and they show up on best of lists. I said, I'm getting deep in the hole. And so now sometimes when I see kind of a messy murder, I don't really want like serial murders or something like that, but I love this book. And she is, I have to say, Makita Brotman is an academic. So the book's well written and it comes from a intellectual perspective, but
it's unputdownable, somebody said.
Somebody said that. Yeah. So it takes place in Tallahassee, which is almost like a character. Like, you can almost feel the swampiness of the whole book. Tallahassee is a very, it's like somebody said, actually in another novel I read, it's like South Georgia in Florida. So it's very heavily Southern Baptist, and the families in the real book are very religious. They go to church school. They spend a lot of time at church. They are devout. They stay away from worldly temptations. So the kids, four of the kids grow up, they get married, and they have this like post-wedding rumspringa. Like, they do it, not like the Amish, a little later. And so they are I mean, they're doing serious, like, sexual stuff, drugs. They go to Eagles concerts. That's one of my good jokes. But it's true. They're like, they're and they're having the time of their lives. But then two of the four want to settle down. They're like, it's time to have kids. It's time to embrace our families again. Go to church more than once a week. They're still going on Sundays. But, you know, go to, you know, yeah. really be invested. And the other two are like, oh, no, we're having too much fun. So they start an affair on their own. And they fall in love, whatever, quid quotes. And but they can't get divorced because that would be a that would be just too sinful. Yeah. But what if one of the other people found an untimely demise? Maybe that would be okay. So anyway, not going to say anything, all the complications. And half the interesting thing about this book is the crime, because, you know, there's a crime. It's true crime. It took like 15 years for them to figure to bring anybody to justice because everybody knew, but nobody said anything. So this is also about like the changing culture that led to this and pop cultural things, true crime podcasts and the television shows that sort of led to this uncovering. And also, it's a really interesting look at psychology, like what mainly finally made somebody crack.
Boy.
So I liked it.
That sounds really interesting. Well, that almost feels like a novel. So let's go back to novels. And how about Like Mother by Susan Rieger?
Thank you so much. That was so what I was like. I was like putting little ESP vibes in, like, say Like Mother, Like Mother. Because part of that book takes place in Tallahassee. So it is I love three-generation novels. I think Real Americans from my summer list is one of those. And Sandwich is three generations and Same as It Ever Was. So this is the middle, Lila, who is the middle, the woman in the middle. She is a world-famous newspaper publisher, kind of at this thing called the Washington Globe, which is kind of like the Washington Post, only a little more tabloidy. Like, she just wants to uncover the dirt on anybody. And so she has made a name for herself. Like, she's retiring. And the problem is her daughter, Grace, who has not gotten along with her very well over the years, has written a Romana Clef that's become a huge hit about the family. And not only does she do things like say that her mother had affairs, which her father doesn't know about and to our knowledge may not be true, she also claims that the story they tell themselves about Lila's mother, Zelda, that Zelda, after an abusive relationship, was sent to an asylum and died. Grace, the granddaughter, says, I don't think it's true. So the story is about the three of them and the mystery of what exactly happened. It is filled with characters. The cities come to life, though. I asked the author if she had been to all these places. She said, well, I actually did use Dr. Google quite a bit. But so the Detroit, which represents the industry, New York and Washington, media and government, and Tallahassee, which is where one of the characters comes from, also from a very devout family. The book is has some DNA quest, you know, like very contemporary stories about DNA. So it is another, like that book, Danny Shapiro's Inheritance, like, be careful when you take your DNA test because you never know what you're going to find out. It's funny, like Pineapple Street that I really loved, or Marrying the Ketchups. And she has a lot of interesting things to say. She's she told me that she doesn't really read fiction of this. Like, she writes differently from she reads, which is not unusual because I kept saying, I feel like you're channeling Laurie Colwin. And I was worried about saying it because she's like, who's Laurie Colwin? So, but that can be tricky, right? You know? So anyway, it's actually my favorite book of the year, I think. It didn't get tons of attention. It was a Barnes & Noble book club pick for November. So somebody liked it. And my friend at Books & Company loved it. And Lake Forest Bookshop, got an email for them with three of their booksellers loving it. So there are people loving it, but it has to find its audience. Like Mother, Like Mother.
By Susan
Rieger.
Is how it's pronounced. Okay. This title might be great for the millennial on your list, although I find it interesting, too. As someone who grew up with Disney, it's called Disney High. Now, that's back to nonfiction. The untold story of the rise and fall of Disney Channel's tween empire.
You talk to somebody, more likely a woman, in their 20s, and you start saying, I just read a book about the Disney Channel. They're like, blah, 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 blah. They want to talk about the various shows and things. It's a fascinating pop culture book. But it's also a really interesting business story about media, about entrepreneurship, about branding. So basically, there was a channel. It was on, it was like HBO. It was on the paid tier. It was called The Disney Channel. And it had the Mickey Mouse Club. And you might know the Mickey Mouse Club, the new Mickey Mouse Club, not the one from the 50s, was only on for a couple of years, but graduated all these huge stars.
Yeah.
The two people from NSYNC, Britney Spears, Christina Aguilera, Carrie Russell, just like so many folks, Ryan Gosling. And what happened is Disney was really pissed because all those people did movies at other studios, recorded their albums at other labels, and they got nothing out of it. And they said, we're going to change that. We're going to become a factory and we're going to have synergy. So the first thing they did is they moved the channel from the paid tier to the free tier. And then the second thing they did was, to me, the most hilarious thing ever. They changed the name of the network from The Disney Channel to Disney Channel. And this was a really big deal. And I have to tell you, there are other organizations I work with that have no the that you want to say the. Yeah. And if I ever, in like a newsletter or something, write the, they will write back to me and say, there's no the. So this is a big, this is like the grammar police are after you. So it follows from the shows after Lizzie McGuire to I think it's Sunny with a Chance, or to put it in star language, Hilary Duff to Demi Lovato. And looking at each one and what did they do? Who could be a Disney star? Like who broke? I think people know the Demi Lovato story. If they don't, they know that it didn't. I mean, she's a star, but the Disney Channel stuff didn't work for her. Hilary Duff was a model Disney citizen, as was Selena Gomez. But it's also the people behind the scenes. Why did they have so much material? How were they able to compete against Nickelodeon, which was the original? That was who they were going after. Nickelodeon was kids only. This was family friendly, so adults were involved. What is crazy is like this happened as the sitcom business collapsed. So they had all this talent that had no place to go because Disney didn't pay as much as sitcoms, but they're like, well, I'd like to work. So I found, what happens when one of your stars didn't want to sing, for God's sake? How are you supposed to make money off of them if they don't want to sing and their plush merchandise isn't doing well? Anyway, I really enjoyed it. I have only one beef with the show is the book. There's an obvious place to end, and that would have been with the announcement of the Disney Plus streaming app. But in fact, she ends it a little earlier, and I think she just like, okay, that's enough. That's enough of all these shows. Plus, they're you know, even before the Disney app, you know, with the rise of Netflix, cable started declining it to the point where, like, what was it, last week, the week before, NBC said they're dumping all their cable channels, except for Bravo for some reason. It's a different world. Which is not on the Disney Channel. That's somewhere else.
Well, I have a 21-year-old daughter who would be well attuned to some of this.
Oh my God, the money that company made on that network is amazing, from the merchandise and stuff. Yeah. I have to say, I didn't watch too much of the live action, but I was and this is only the live action. So my other disappointment was like, what? No chapter on Phineas and Ferb? But can't have everything. That'll be another book.
Oh, yeah.
That's such a good show.
It was such a good show. Oh. I think I've seen every single episode.
Oh, we're in the club together.
Well, let's go back to fiction here for a minute with The Mighty Red by Louise Erdrich.
Erdrich. God, such an amazing book. I went on a tear. You know, one of my things is I've been reading Louise Erdrich for a long time. I read Love Medicine many, many years ago. Then what would happen is I had so many when I was a bookseller and we'd get a finished, an ARC, an advanced copy. I never could get one because there were so many readers on staff that I had to be nice and give it to other people. But we did a book club for two of her books. And finally this year, for the first time in 16 years, she came to Milwaukee. I was so excited, but I was worried because she's written a lot of different kinds of books too. She's been writing dystopian books and ghost stories and historicals and courtroom thrillers, some of which I've really liked. But this is a return to very classic. In fact, it's a classic urge. In fact, it's sort of a bookend to her second novel, The Beet Queen, because it returns to the sugar beet country of North Dakota. It follows a number of characters, but the focus is, she always has a wide canvas of characters, but the real focus is a mother and daughter, Crystal and Kismet, and their relationship. And Kismet is also in a love triangle, which is, of course, one of the six best plots. So she's got the athlete, kind of the insecure but popular athlete who's got a secret in his past, and she's got the nerdy bookseller who keeps to himself but is very good at recommending books to people, and you know whose side I was on, but you know. But she's got such a dry wit. I love that. I love the way she talks about the environment. There's so much about the land. I love the way she writes indigenous characters who are a little removed from their culture. You know, they feel a little lost because they have lost some of their culture, which I really enjoyed. And of course, there is, like in a few other books that I've read this year, the bookstore, which is one of the people has a bookstore. So they have some book club meetings, and there's some hilarious conversations about books in the story too. So it's a terrific book.
And by the way, you have another one. Speaking of bookstores, another book that you have is titled "The Bookshop: A History of the American Bookstore." That's a nonfiction, I believe.
It is a nonfiction book. It is. There are more than one of these in the world. And I have to tell you that I have, the only caveat is, you know, when you're in the business, you know, when you read that history of radio talk show hosts, Larry, and you're like, wait a minute, this detail is wrong. So that sometimes happened to me, but in general, I found it very entertaining, and people who like books in general would really enjoy it. It starts with like Ben Franklin. It's also, American centric. So there's not a lot about international bookstores, of which you could write 150 more books. But it's got the Strand and the Fourth Avenue bookstores, which were a really interesting phenomenon in New York, where the bookstores would group together. That was something that was very common with secondhand stores, where you wind up being in bunches up. But even like when I was growing up in New York, there were a whole bunch of new bookstores like in a row along Fifth Avenue. He's got a really interesting chapter on a black-owned bookstore from Washington, D.C. that no longer exists. He's got a Barnes & Noble chapter. There's an Amazon chapter, including those short-lived Amazon bookstores. There's a Parnassus chapter, which I enjoyed a lot. And then, of course, there's a chapter on the Marshall Field's book department in Chicago, which at one time took up half of the third floor. And what people don't know, because we have a now sense of history, is that there was a period in the 60s where the department store bookstores really dominated the book trade, such that the American Bookstore Association, like, it was a good percentage of the board of directors were department store book managers.
Wow.
But that, you know, that's gone, though there's still a leased department down in State Street in Chicago. So anyway, I really enjoyed this a lot. I did get, somebody's like, are you in it? And I was like, we got a line, a throwaway line, which I'm very appreciative of. But I, you know, there were certain people like Joyce Meskis at Tattered Cover. Was like, she's the Tattered Cover, which is now owned by Barnes & Noble. But at the time, when the story in The New Yorker came out about Tattered Cover, I think it was in the late 80s, that is said to be one of the main impetuses for the Barnes & Noble Superstore. Like, because they said the best bookstore in the United States is not in New York. And I always found that story very interesting. But Joyce has passed away. And I don't know who is there to tell it. Or, you know, like, he has to, with all these things, you have to make a decision of what to include and what to leave out. And sometimes the reasoning behind what you include and what to leave out, I'd love to hear, because it's a really interesting story in itself.
It would be indeed. So that book is titled The Bookshop, A History of American, of the American Bookstore. And you got it from our guest, Daniel Golden, owner of Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee. Questions or comments for him? I see we have some emails up. If you'd like to email us, you can do that. Go to talk@WPR.org. Or you can give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Give a call. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Daniel Golden of Boswell Book Company has been giving us a list. Oh, I don't know. I think we've gone through seven or eight of them now of the 20 books on his list of suggestions for books for purchase for yourself or maybe as a gift for someone else. Jen in Madison emailed us. And by the way, you can email to talk@WPR.org. And I should mention you can phone us at 1-800-347-9056. I believe I got, did I get that right? No, I didn't get that right. 1-800-642-1234. I don't know where that other number came from, but anyway, it's 800-642-1234. Linda had emailed us. She'd like to promote Inklink Bookstore in East Troy. Kayleen is an awesome owner. You probably know.
She is an awesome owner. You have to, the only suggestion I made, it's a beautiful store. She has really great taste. She always has wonderful recommendations. You need to make sure, check their website for the hours. Because because not everybody has very long hours. And so go, you know, that's.
You have long hours.
We have longer hours than some. It is true. We don't have the longest hours. We have a little shorter than we used to have hours, but we have relatively, you know, relatively long hours, yes.
Yeah. Jen in Madison emailed us. Jen has a 13-year-old boy who likes Jen to read to him at night, and they just finished the Harry Potter series. That's a lot of reading for you, Jen. They're looking for a new series to start with him this holiday season. He's interested in mythology, war, but those aren't Jen's favorite subject. So they'd like some ideas for what they might move on to next.
There's so many, you know, especially because of Potter being such a phenomenon that you have, like, the world is your oyster. The book that's very hot now and is very big in the United States and a phenomenon in Great Britain is Impossible Creatures by Catherine Rundell. She is has written a lot of wonderful contemporary and historical non-fantasy novels over the years. She is obviously a very, very talented writer. She actually has two books that are selling incredibly well now. She also has an adult book called Vanishing Treasures, A Bestiary of Extraordinary Endangered Creatures that is selling phenomenally well on the adult side. And it's nature, so you might be interested in it.
Yeah.
So I'm making that recommendation to you. But the reviews were terrific. People have compared it to Potter and also Narnia books. And it is definitely going to be a series. Ages 10 and up. So probably more on the lines of the age range of the earlier Potters. It's a very unusual series because it ages up as you go through which worked well as the books came out, but now is a little weird. You start it with an 8-year-old and you get to book 6 and you're like, woo, should they be reading this? But I am not their parent. So.
But Impossible Creatures.
Impossible Creatures by Catherine Rundell. That is my recommendation.
All right. Pat in Deerfield emailed us. Do you need to read Mark Twain before reading James?
Well, this is the thing. I am living proof that you do not. However, and I know some people who read like the Cliff Notes, you know, Spark Notes. But I will say that I've talked to I was just talking to one of my sisters about this. She always reads the source material for her book clubs. So I really like the book Absolution, which I think I talked about last year by Alice McDermott, not the new Jeff Vandermeer. And she read The Quiet American by Graham Greene. She read, I'm reading, our book club is doing the book The House of Doors by Tan Thuan Eng in January. And Claudia read that, and she read the Somerset Maugham story that's connected to it. So she would say, absolutely. I will say that people who have read both say it is a better reading experience. But I have vowed, because one of my women in my book club is a huge Mark Twain fan, I have vowed to read Adventures of Huckleberry Finn before the end of the year. You can hold me to this, Larry. And
I'm going to ask you.
I mean, I'm really set up. I've got the book. I've got a Mark Twain finger puppet, and I'm ready for Ron Chernow. You know, Ron Chernow's next big biography is Mark Twain, coming next spring.
Oh,
so it's Mark Twain-a-mania. And so, no, you don't, but it definitely enhances the experience.
All right.
That was a long answer. Sorry.
No, it was a good answer. I like that answer. Mary sent us an email. A friend of Mary's likes crime mystery books by Michael Connelly, who, and I like Michael Connelly.
Larry, you can make the recommendations.
If you are familiar with this author, are there other authors who write similar books that you could recommend? So Michael Connelly like books.
Well, what would you recommend?
Authors.
You know, I always go back to Nick Petrie, but he's more thrillery.
Yeah.
You know, he's not like Connelly. I get it. So.
Yeah. Neither is Lee Child, who I've, that's the other author that I read a lot, the Jack Reacher series.
You think Parker is like him?
Parker? Maybe.
A little. Somebody's got it. I will tell you, it's going to come to me, and I'm going to shout it out randomly in the middle of another review.
yeah, Michael, I will say that I do read all of Lee Child's books and all of Michael Connelly's books, and I like them both, but they're not the same style.
Though I will say some people do. I've seen comparisons. What about,
Jonathan Kellerman?
Yeah. How about Ian Rankin? Those are police novels. What about John Sanford?
Oh, yeah. See, John Sanford, I've read all of his too. And his style, some ways, is close. The exchange, the verbal exchanges between people in Sanford's books, I've always loved the sort of the wry humor,
yeah.
That
the it's like the mystery equivalent of romantic pattern romances. Banter.
I love the banter.
Oh, Robert Crace. Early Robert Crace especially.
Yeah, early.
That's a detective. They get darker. Like, it's interesting enough, like Laura Lippman's the same way. The early ones are a little, I mean, they're still killings, but they're less. We were just talking about this with Lise Petty, that the new one is particularly dark.
Yeah.
But they a lot of writers start out a little lighter. The Elvis Cole books are set in L.A. They're very good. And there's some people, like, do you ever hear this with Lee Child? I'm sure I've said this to you before, that people say to start with book five because he gets better.
He gets better. Well, that's considered, I think, book five, forgetting the title, but I know it's always considered his best book.
Yeah. Well, why do you have to?
But Sanford, I wouldn't start at the beginning with John Sanford books.
Either. Yeah.
About halfway through, I'd go.
Okay. Fair enough.
And, you know, you can find those books. But I think, yeah.
I think we've given her a good selection.
I think we have. Well, what about the books that are actually on our list here?
Oh, those? Yeah.
Well, let's go back to fiction for a minute here.
Okay.
Kat Tank's book, Five Star Stranger. That sounds kind of
This is a quiet
unique.
Little book that I really liked.
Yeah, it sounds really unique.
I have a backstory, if I may.
Okay.
So I read this book because I had, as I mentioned in the summer show, really liked a book called Real Americans by Rachel Kang. And you shouldn't really fall in love with blurbs. Like, I do pay attention to them. You know, when I see an Ann Patchett thing, I go, oh, I'm going to read you that. Sandwich. I think that's the reason I read Sandwich, which has become so popular. There's another book in the spring that I really liked called Sipsworth that's selling like crazy at independent bookstores. Another Patchett pick, though I've read him before. So this had a Rachel Kung quote, Kat Tang writes with care and clarity, perception and perfect comedic timing about what it means to be loved and loved. So that was what drew me to it. But my backstory is, you know about seat fillers?
Yeah.
So if people don't know, like at awards shows and other television shows, somebody is paid a small amount of money to sit in the empty seats so that it doesn't look so bad. So one of my coworkers, Jen, grew up in Los Angeles, and she was a seat filler for the Mary Lou Henner talk show. So imagine if you were a seat filler for things like weddings, funerals, birthday parties, and even people's lives. So that's what this character is. He's another unnamed narrator who is paid to be part of someone's life, fill in at a wedding, or, for example, in this case, in addition to the weddings and funerals and birthday parties and anniversary parties and reunions, he is asked to be the missing father of this young girl and her mother. And he's also asked to be the alcoholic brother of this woman who's trying to write a memoir about her brother. So he's got all these jobs, and he's also, you're following him as he's getting ready for the programs and as he goes into the programs. But needless to say, he starts getting a little too attached to the people that he's not real. They're paying him. He's not really connected to them. I found this book funny and interesting, but what this idea of being in service, and it reminded me a lot of all things, the novels of Kazuo Ishiguro. Remains of the Day, where he's the servant, the book where you follow the doll, the last novel, the book where you have the clones, where they're all, that's what they are. They're like, the meaning of their lives is really dependent on others. And I thought she did a good job expanding on that. I thought it was, I enjoyed the book a lot. It's just, like I said, it's a small first novel, but I really enjoyed it.
All right, so it had some humor in it, but I'm just trying to put myself in that guy's position. I was trying to put myself in that person's position of doing that. I guess I'd be somebody who would just get so involved in the other people's lives, or want to be involved in those people's lives, and maybe they could care less.
That's right. But and it would certainly lead to an identity crisis with yourself. Like, who am I if I'm only in representation?
If all I'm good for is
being something for somebody else. Whoop. Makes you think.
Well, and it is a small, I mean, it's us.
It's pretty small. It's not too, I read a lot of really short books. It's 226.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's so reasonable. I consider a novella under 200. Like, one of the most popular books we're selling right now is The Serviceberry, which is,
I've heard of that.
From the author of Braiding Sweetgrass. It is a phenomenon. We're out. Whoops. But we think we're going to still get more before Christmas, we hope. It is giving a lot of people are buying, Robin Wall Kimmerer, a lot of people are giving like multiple copies as gifts and things. But it is only, I'm going to look it up and see how many pages it is.
What's the title again?
The Serviceberry.
Yeah, The Serviceberry.
I didn't read it because one of my other books, always Kay read it and loved it. It's only 128 pages and it's small trim size too. But see, you can pack a lot of punch into small pages.
And on that note, you can indeed. Daniel Golden, our guest today, owner of Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee, and we're talking about his 20 books, but we've gotten into at least another 15 or so. I do too. It's always a lot of fun. And he'll be with us after we take a look at the news for another half hour to talk about his recommendations. And looking forward to you joining in too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for joining in today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're taking a look at books for the holiday season, fiction, nonfiction, with our guest Daniel Golden, owner of Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee. It's always great to have him come by. And questions or comments or maybe a recommendation, the number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Well, I want to go to one of the books that is actually set in Milwaukee, and it's it's called Hampton Heights by Dan Cloyce.
Yeah, usually I have several local books, and there are still out this year, but on my list, Wisconsin books. But this is the one that I've got. It is. It came out this fall. It is possibly for whenever one reads books about monsters. So the subtitle is One Harrowing Night in the Most Haunted Neighborhood in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. By the way, Hampton Heights doesn't exist as a neighborhood, but it seems to be approximately 43rd in Hampton, which is actually also very close to where the author Dan Cloyce grew up. Why I think this book is so interesting is it represents a trend in fiction, which is cozy everything. Now, you know, cozy mysteries. That's where the mystery happens off stage, and there's a lot of banter and usually a romance. But in the last few years, cozy fantasy and cozy fantasy has really taken over. And that's when an alien and a predator open a coffee shop together. And so it's sort of everything is a little softer and engaging. Japanese fiction has a lot of cozy elements before the coffee gets cold, for example. And so this is what I would call cozy horror. Now, they know that it is horror adjacent because it's got a quote from perhaps one of the biggest horror writers at the moment, who isn't Stephen King, Paul Tremblay, who wrote the wild reimagining of the coming of age novel I Didn't Know I Needed Right Now, which, by the way, that I didn't know I needed or I needed is also, that's a trope in blurbs, and you should use it once or twice when you're recommending something. I'll try to say that before the end of the show. So it is a set play in the late 70s, and it is about a group of Milwaukee Sentinel newspaper carriers who are asked to do a subscription drive in this neighborhood. And so six of them go off with their supervisor. They divide up into teams of two. And if they are successful, they will have the reward, which is always needed at a quest, which is dinner at Burger King. And so each of the two groups goes, and they all... each has a different theme. Each part of the book has a different theme. And each one has a different monster. And they are vaguely scary, but not particularly scary. There's almost a Grimm's fairy tale story about it. And the supervisor also gets his own chapter as well. Things about race and gender and, class and gender dynamics and dating and things like that. They all play into it. He's got a good sense of humor. And like I said, if you're like, I want horror, but I don't want to be too scared, but I do want some monsters, that's a good book for you.
Another one that I wanted to bring up was The Ministry of Time. I'm wondering, is this similar to books like The Time Traveler's Wife?
Well, time travel is... I have a bookseller, Jenny, I work with, who will read any time travel book that she comes across. And this is a very different take on it. So, but it is... any book about time travel has some ideas about, like, what are the rules and what can you do. So in this case... this is sort of a hybrid of several different genres, and it is to prove that, yes, Daniel does read some fantasy-adjacent speculative books. It is about an office in Great Britain that is in charge of rescuing people from time. So in the case of this book, it's also an unnamed narrator, so I will call her narrator, just so we know who we're talking about. She... is in charge of a person who was on the expedition, the Franklin Expedition, which is a famous ship disaster. And Graham Gore, one of the people on the ship, is brought to the present, put in isolation with a bunch of other people who have also been rescued through time, and they're going to train them to live in the real world and also, or the current world, and also probably use them for something or other. There's a reason why they're pulling these people out of time. We don't really know why. Is it for some nefarious purpose? Of course it is. And does she know that? Of course she doesn't. And of course, what is she supposed to not do with this man? And that would be fall in love with him, of course. So you've got that as well. The book is definitely got is literary fiction adjacent to, which, as many would say, is just another genre. But it's got the reviews from Ron Charles and the Washington Post and a number of other people. Very actually strong reviews. She also, you can tell from her blurbs that she runs with the literary crowd in Great Britain. One of the really interesting things is that, in a way, these refugees are like refugees. And you see the parallels between what it's like for people to come leave their homes, not of their own will, really, but because of war or starvation, and try to make another place, some fitting in better than others, and not being there. Kellyanne Bradley is, I believe, biracial Cambodian from a refugee family. And so she writes that really interestingly into the story. But that's all said. It's mostly a big, over-the-top, speculative adventure.
The Ministry of Time. Well, David in New Richmond has a comment for us. Let's go there. Hi, David.
Hey, I've got a couple recommendations based on a lucky trip we were able to take for our anniversary to our 50th state. One of them is on, I believe, like NPR's list, The Wide, Wide Sea by Hampton Sides, excuse me. It's a story of an actual notes and interviews from the Captain Cook, his adventures to actually all around the world, but specifically to Hawaii and then the Aleutian Islands. And it's really a great story on what they did back in the day, and just wooden boats and the travels and the problems they had, and the interactions with different cultures. And it's all accurate, kind of a book documentary thing. And the other one is I know Nick Offerman has one out with the same name, Paddle Your Own Canoe, but there's a Hawaii author that has a book out called Paddle Your Own Canoe. And she traversed the length of Molokai Island on the north side, which is the most treacherous island in the chain over there. And she did it by swimming the island and would wash up on shores, time her waves to wash herself up on shore. And it was quite the story of perseverance, and something that a person just decided to do because they saw a place that, wow, I'd like to try that. I think I can do it. And this is a woman who was 45 years old and 110 pounds. Mm. So really, really quite interesting. And those would be my two recommendations.
The Wild Wide Sea and Paddle
Wide,
Your,
Wide Sea.
And Paddle,
yep,
Your,
and
Own,
Paddle
Canoe.
Your Own Canoe.
Yeah.
Yes, Nick Offerman also wrote one, Paddle Your Own Canoe, but I haven't read that one.
So that's the Audrey Sutherland one?
It might be. It's a woman, yes. It's okay. A woman who wrote it.
Wide White Sea just got on that New York Times Best Books of the Year list.
The Wide Wide Sea?
I think so, yeah.
Okay, and it's on NPR's list. I know that. David mentioned that.
Yeah, Hampton Sides, yeah. So he's looking for watery books. I don't know if I have anything.
thank you very much, David. Appreciate your call. You know, I wanted to bring up Lost in Austin, which is a nonfiction book, and you recommended it, and I had recently interviewed a guy who wrote a book. It's set in It's a the title was A Natural History of Empty Lots by Christopher Brown, and it's set in and it's nonfiction, and yeah. it's set in Austin.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah,
he bought an empty lot in a rundown section of Austin, but this book, Lost in Austin, is the evolution of an American city.
It's a lot. It's definitely, I mean, it is also a first person narrative, just like the other book. It is he's a journalist who moves to Austin in search of a better life. Austin, you know, from the days of slackers to the Keep Austin Weird campaign, and then South by Southwest. It's really about a city that grows so much that it loses its soul, I guess yeah. you'd say. And so he kind of tries to look at how this went from this quirky, hip college town to what is now, you know, for better or worse, the utopia for... utopia for somebody or other. So I love books about cities. I thought it was an interesting book to read. Madison's had so much growth in the past few years and will continue to have it. Milwaukee has not had the kind of growth Madison has, but certainly would like that kind of growth. Cavalier Johnson would like to double the population. I think it's something, a book that somebody should read. To see like what you lose when you gain, when you grow really quickly in a place. You know, Portland, Oregon tried to measure their growth, but in a way you can't really control people coming in. I mean, this is the story on so many levels. I remember the old story about Seattle, you know, though when the last person gets here, you know, close the door because it won't be the same. And it isn't. And you just, I guess people... what I was trying to say, it went from the quirky town to like a libertarian paradise. Very, very different culture there now has become dominant with so many tech gurus coming there. And, you know, South by Southwest was sort of a blessing and a curse for the city. And the tech growth, much like it was for San Francisco, wound up changing the culture of the city. Now, for some people would say it's all changed for the better. It's really a matter of opinion, isn't it? Some things, though, like environmental problems, like the watering holes that people loved, are, you know, in danger, for example. But a lot of the scale, there was a beautiful book that I read like 40 years ago, Larry, about called The Experience of Place by, I think, Tony Hiss, that talked about like, what is it about a city that changes that makes you love it less? Like sometimes mm-hmm. it's just like one building that goes away. Like all these other things can change. And then when you lose that train station or something like that, yeah. like your center of the city is gone. And so it's just something for people to read, to think about.
I thought about when you mentioned, when I saw that book, I thought right away of how Austin and Madison were often compared together.
Right. Right.
And Madison's kind of going the way that Austin, I mean, was sort of a step behind it a little bit, but on that direction.
A little slower, yeah.
A little slower, but definitely going the same.
Going in the same direction.
Going in the same direction.
And, you know, and of course, there are winners and losers in these sort of things. And, you know, you would if every boat was lifted equally, then you would say, well, you know, you have to give things up for positive change. But that usually isn't the case.
The Driving Machine, a design history of the car, and you're not exactly a car lover.
No, in fact, most of my books are like Austin, development bad, highways bad, parking bad. what was last year, I had a book called Pay Paradise that I really liked, but part of that is possibly due to not owning a car till I'm 50, but I'm much older than 50 now, so... I can read a book like this and go, yeah, that's really interesting. This is by Witold Rybczynski, who has been writing since for many, many years. I've read probably 7 or 8 of his books. I read one about like redeveloping Charleston. He writes about urban planning. He writes general history. I read one book about the history of the weekend. And he writes a lot about design. And there was a book, a famous book by another writer that I really loved, Henry Petrosky, who you might confuse him with, who wrote like A History of the Pencil. And this was sort of like this. He also has a nice blurb from Robert Sullivan, who I've also liked over the years. The Driving Machine follows the history of car design over the many cars that Rybczynski had over the years. And there are British cars, European cars, American cars. But through that, he, of course, like this conversation today, make many, many, many detours. It is rare that I have a book that I can recommend to car fans. And but I think they'll enjoy it, especially what you think about the pull between the design people, the engineering people, the marketing people, and the bean counters, the accountants. Yeah. And then, of course, the most important person at all, the customer. So often the bombs are the most interesting stories, like the cars, the Edsels and things Edsels. That didn't work. The Edsel. but there are cars that brought down entire companies. And of course, I live near an old, it's now a parts warehouse and it's probably going to be closed, but it was an old Nash plant.
Oh man,
Nash.
Nash so Rambler.
They all come up in here. So, like I said, I think he's a very interesting writer. It is actually, you know, like even if you don't read it, that's a smart looking cover, isn't it?
I love that cover.
Yeah. Very nice.
Susie in Manitowoc, what's on your mind?
Okay. I'm not necessarily plugging a book. I just would like to encourage people to shop their independent bookstores.
Oh, that's wonderful. What's the store that you go to?
La Di Da in Manitowoc.
Oh, yes. I've been there many years ago.
Oh, good. Yeah, Bev is amazing. She might be listening now, and her face is turning red now as I talk to you. The reason we first started shopping there was because we wanted to help Bev out because she's a good friend. Then it was just to keep the independent bookstore alive. And then it's all the services that you get with independent bookstores. The owners know their products. They're able to talk to you about it. And if they cannot get it, they recommend other independent bookstores, which I have used. I've gotten like a book when we're out west somewhere. And Bev has been really very anxious to promote these other independent bookstores. And she has a really good collection of books. She even has used books in the back store. She has a wonderful children's section. I like the idea of independent to keep the local scene alive.
Susie, thank you so much. Well, I'm sure you're not going to disagree.
No, and, you know, it's all the booksellers I know love to spend their free time going to other bookstores. I know I've talked to, we've talked to the folks from Blue House in Kenosha quite a bit, and they've been in the store. Word Haven in Sheboygan. There was a conference in Milwaukee not that long ago, so we saw a lot of booksellers. But that's, you know, whenever I go anywhere, I'm going to Chicago for a concert next week, and I said to one of my sisters who we're going with, I'm like, by the way, we're stopping at some bookstores on the way. So she was she was pretty okay with that. I mean, it's wonderful. There's a wonderful blog called The Indie Bob Spot where he would do like two bookstores a week, and he's gone all around the country. We met him early on when he used to travel with his mom. We also have, there's a few books about bookstores, not like like smaller things than the bookshop, which only has like 10 bookstores in it. But, you know, and people will go around and get them signed, or the indie bookstore map for the Midwest Bookstore Association. Yeah. People would go and like check the bookstores off that they see.
Well, it's whenever I go to a new place, a new city or a new town, I always like to go to the bookstore and just talk to people, talk to the owners and look around. And I make it a point to buy a book, and every one of them. Oh, man. Susie, thank you so much. Well, should we do one more? How about The Anxious Generation by Jonathan Haidt? And this might be an important read for parents.
It is. And you know, the book's been on the bestseller list for people sometimes ask me, like, how do you pick your books? And I'm like, well, actually, you know, I just saw we were selling it and thought, oh, maybe I should read this. And I don't have kids, but I have a nephew who has kids. And so this book is really a fascinating story of how basically his thesis is we overprotect kids in the real world and underprotect them online. And he has a lot of ideas about how to make that change. What's really interesting about the book is a lot of parents are talking about it, and you're actually seeing real policy come out of this book really quickly about restricting access to social media to kids under 16, about the no phones in the classroom. He talks a lot about how it affects boys and girls differently. Girls are affected more by social media, boys by video games. When I talked to my nephew about it, he said, all the parents are talking about this book. And even for somebody like me, I wanted to know, you know, I don't have kids, but I really just wanted to know what was going on in the culture. And I found it very interesting.
Coming up, we have a couple of guests from the CCBC, the Cooperative Children's Book Center, and they have a whole bunch of recommendations for kids. Give me one of your recommendations for kids.
You know, I'm worried they might mention one of them, so I'm going to do the one that they definitely won't do, because they tend to stay. I love that segment, by the way. I listen to it all the time, or every season. And I'm going to do my board book, because I feel like board books are underappreciated. This is Peekaboo Santa. It's a lift the flap without the flaps, and it's got a mirror in the back because that's baby's favorite toy. That's all I'm saying.
Well, I tell you what, there weren't any crossovers. So.
Oh, there weren't. I mentioned the Bletchley riddle, but that's on the bestseller list. People know that. Really great middle grade book. Loved
or
it.
Buffalo Fluffalo.
Oh, Buffalo Fluffalo. That's our big picture book. And you know what you say at the end of this segment? You say, Buffalo Fluffalo, I've had enough-alo. So.
Well, that's enough alone for you today. But it has been such a pleasure, always is, Daniel. Thank you so much, and we'll look forward to your next visit, probably in spring when when we do the summer's reading selections.
Okay, see you in 6 months.
Daniel Golden of Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee. He's got a wonderful bookstore in Milwaukee, Boswell Book Company. And great to have him with us. And as I said, coming up, we're going to dig more into the children's book side of things with a couple of folks from the Cooperative Children's Book Center. I'm Larry Mueller. Books can really make an impact on a child, and that's why they make great gifts during the holiday season. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on WPR. We have a couple of guests from the CCBC, as I always called it, the Cooperative Children's Book Center. One of them is Tessa Michelson-Schmidt in the studio. She is director of the CCBC. Tessa, welcome. Good to
Thanks,
have you
Larry.
With. Great to have you here. And Megan Schliesman is with us as well, and is the assistant director of the Cooperative Children's Book Center. And Megan, great to have you with us.
Thank you, Larry. It's great to be here.
As we talk with the two, I want to hear from you. What's your favorite book to give a child? What new children's books would you recommend? Did you get a book as a gift that made a big difference in your life? Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. Maybe for those who aren't familiar, talk about the Cooperative Children's Book Center. What do you do there? And Tessa, maybe you?
Sure. Larry, the CCBC, the Cooperative Children's Book Center, is a library of the School of Education at the University of Wisconsin, and we also receive funding from the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction. We are an examination library, primarily of new and contemporary books for children and teens. And our primary audience is the adults who work with children and teens. So we have pre-service teachers and librarians, art students coming to use us on campus. And part of our extensive outreach is working with public librarians, school librarians, educators, teachers, preschool teachers around the state.
Yeah. Megan, what makes a great children's book?
A great children's book. Well, I think a great children's book starts with a book that really draws the audience in. And if it includes a written narrative, we want that narrative to be really well done and engaging. If there's visual elements, we want those to be really thoughtfully presented. But really, what makes a great children's book often depends on the type of book and the age of the audience. Yeah. So those are very broad statements.
Have there been some trends or what have you seen in the way of trends? I know there's certainly been trends in the adult side of things, but what about on the children's side?
I'll say one huge trend that we've seen over the past 10 plus years is just the explosive increase in the number of graphic novels that are being published with a youth audience in mind.
And how would you define a graphic novel?
So, now we're getting into, people have probably written dissertations on this, Larry. But a graphic novel is really panel art. Some people think of it as comic art, but okay, presented in a book format. So it's really integrating words and images to tell the story or present information.
Well, let's take a look at the list you created. And the first one up is Animal Albums from A to D, or A to Z, I'm sorry, not A to D, A to Z by C. Spell. Why might a child love the humorous poems in this book?
I think this book offers so much humor for adults and children to explore together. It's also a book that can be read by a wide age range. I think we've recommended it from kids about 4 years old through 10, and certainly adults, especially adults with an interest in or experience with vinyl records, will love the albums in this alphabetical, alliterative animal album. There's a lot going on here. That's how I'm going to say it. C.C. Bell wrote and illustrated this marvelous book that takes one animal, one album for every spread, and you can skip around in it or read it from A to Z. You can also go online and listen to performances of each song that's featured in the book. The lyrics almost read like really silly, fun poems. There's a lot of jokes to pick up in the illustrations as well. And they're just a range of music styles as well as animal humor in each spread.
So, and the age range again is up to
4 through 10 plus.
I like that. Next on the list, and I will, and then we'll take a call here. Next is Log Life by Amy Hevron. And it's about nurse logs and what the heck are nurse logs?
I am so glad you asked. I'm also going to talk about what that is. And I want to kind of compare the two books that we have by Amy Hevron, both written and illustrated, starting with Log Life. This is a little series that she's done called Tiny Habitats. And a nurse log is a habitat that she invites really young readers to explore. What is this? With the question, what happens when a giant fir tree falls in the forest? The question is not whether or not it makes a sound. This is really what happens to it after it hits the floor of the forest. And there's five chapters in this book that each explore wide spanses of time. So after 1 year, after 10 year, after 100 years, 500 years, 1,000 years, what happens as this log begins to decay? Now, this might not sound like the most exciting topic to delve into, but almost immediately, different animals and plants in the forest see this as a new environment to thrive on, whether they are seeking protection or they are going to be eating parts of the dying tree. And throughout the years, it just brings so much life and is its own ecosystem. So there's fascinating science. I think a lot of adults probably didn't know all of these features of a nurse log and how it tends and cares to a whole range of animals and plants. But I'll tell you, the illustrations in this book, as well as in Sunken Ship, are just delightful. They make the science so accessible, and I'm going to say it, they're so cute. Even lichen. Who thought the lichen would be cute? Well, I believe you. Check out Log Life and you'll see
And the age range on that is?
The age range, again, 4 to 7. Could be a little younger, could be a little older, depending on, again, as Megan said, who's the reader and how they might be reading it with an adult. And similarly, I'm just going to add that Sunken Ship also explores.
Also by her.
Also written and illustrated by her in the Tiny Habitats book series, exploring a human-made reef in an ocean. So it starts in the year 1733 with a Spanish galleon sailing the seas, but ends up sinking off the coast of the Florida Keys. And again, over these large chapters of time spans, begins to take on new life, again, offering some protection as the book begins, or the ship rather, begins to decay, becoming food for different animals in the ocean, and also becoming a way of preventing erosion because of the way it changes the shifting ocean floor. So really a lot of fascinating science, but done with a lot of really accessible text and very inviting illustrations.
Which is why her series, her books are successful.
We think so.
Well, and we something we often say is that even as adults, we appreciate how much we learn reading children's books.
Oh, yeah. Believe me, I learned plenty. Bonnie in Peterson, Minnesota has a comment on a book that I read many times. Bonnie, hi.
Hi. Well, this is a book that I can hardly get through without crying. It just gets me every time. It's The Giving Tree by Shel Silverstein. And, of course, it's the story of a little boy that goes through the life of a tree. And as he's a little boy, he plays in the branches, and the tree is so happy. And then he, you know, later gets married and has to build a house and cuts down the branches to build a house and cuts down the, you know, stump to build a boat and all that. And at the end, you know, the tree says, come, sit down. He's an old man. And he does. He sits down on the stump, and the tree was happy.
Yeah.
I just love it. And, it's kind of a nice, you know, nice story, kind of a nice moral that, you know, you need to take care of things.
Yeah, thank you for calling. And Megan, you're nodding in kind of agreement with that.
Well, sure, that's a book that I think many people across quite a few generations have really appreciated over the years.
What about the book At the End of the Day? It sounds very similar to the classic Alexander and what is it? The Terrible, Horrible... No Good,
Well,
Very Bad Day, I think is what the book title of that other book was.
Yeah, that's an interesting comparison and not an invalid one. I'm actually going to pair that book with another book on the list called Chooch Helped, because they're both about scenarios that I think are going to be relatable to many families with young children. So At the End of the Day opens with the line, at the end of the day, sometimes everyone is exhausted or bored or in a mood. So that is something, again, that I think many families can relate to. And in this particular family, we see there's just a litany of reasons why they sometimes find the end of the day a challenge, from homework and piano lessons and chores to the mismatched stinky socks that they have to pick up. But what I love in the story is we also see how small things can turn that feeling of frustration to delight, and even moments of unexpected pleasure. So it turns out that things like laughter that follows an especially good knock-knock joke, or when the missing puzzle piece is found, can make that day really wonderful by the time it's over. There are two additional things we really appreciate about this book. Multiple things, three at least. It's a mixed-race family. The mom in the story is serving in the military. And then it's by a Wisconsin author. Lisa Detlefson lives here in the state.
Yeah, that is very cool. And you were pairing it with...
Yeah, so Chooch Helped by Andrea Rogers is a story about the frustration of a big sister whose little brother just gets away with everything.
Oh.
So everyone else in her family lets Chooch, her toddler brother, help out with whatever they're doing, but he always makes a mess. So the older sister who is narrating the story is having none of it when he tries to help her, and she gets mad and she yells at him, which makes her parents mad and they yell at her. So it's this universal story of sibling tension that's really, first of all, beautifully grounded in the specifics of this Cherokee family and their culture. But two other things I really love in this book is how the parents apologize for yelling at her. They realize that they overreacted too. But also, they help her understand that her little brother wants nothing more than to be like her. And that helps her really find her patience and show him how to do what he wanted to help her
that
with.
That sounds wonderful. Next is, I'm going through this list fairly quickly here because we've got a lot of them. Next is Born Naughty, My Childhood in China by Jin Wang.
Yes. I think this
with
is...
With Tony Johnson, I think.
Yeah. Born Naughty is tells a lot about the author's life growing up in the year 1982 in Inner Mongolia. And what I imagine listeners might really appreciate about this book is how it is so relatable in terms of childhood and sharing episodes of a life growing up, things that might not seem significant at the time, but certainly reflecting back, you can really find the humor and family warmth in. And also just how different the world is and what that can look like in a lot of different places. And I feel like this book really balances both. It's a highly illustrated memoir that could really be read as an early chapter book or as a story to be shared in a grown-up's lap with younger children. And it talks about the author's experience growing up in a tiny village that had about 18 houses that were all very close together and a tiny store that they could purchase things like soy sauce and salt and matches. And it's just very small, very, very rural and poor. But even though there were very few material possessions, there is so much life and vibrancy with this young girl and her brother with her family. And there's a lot of escapades that happen. A few of them are when she travels by wagon with her father to another town's well to get water. And it's the first time that she's ever left this tiny hometown. And she has to beg her ma to be able to go. And her mom is so afraid that she's going to either fall off the wagon or lose her shoes. But again, she's able to leave with her dad to get out of their town, which is such an adventure. She also gets caught in a type of sand tornado, which is something I haven't experienced growing up here in the Midwest. But she gets caught in a big dust storm and comes out looking like a small ghost because being covered head to toe, and especially her freshly oiled hair gets just caked with sand. And she also becomes famous in her tiny village from this experience of being in the sand tornado. So again, things that are both relatable, but perhaps totally new and different. And I think that there's just a lot of humor and just the way that she finds so much comfort from their meager possessions, but with her life and her family in this tiny hut in Inner Mongolia.
Sounds wonderful.
And who's not going to like the title, Born Naughty?
Yeah, absolutely. Pat in Duluth, Minnesota wanted to recommend a book. Pat?
Hi. I just saw this book this morning at a local coffee shop. One of the regulars named her dog after the title, and it's called Dirty Harry. It was published in the 1950s, but it was so sweet. The illustrations are beautiful. A little dog doesn't like to get his baths, and so he buries all the bathing stuff out in his yard, runs off to a construction area, plays with so many other dogs. He comes back home. He's so dirty that his family doesn't think it's him.
I think it's Harry the Dirty Dog.
Harry the Dirty Dog. I read it many times in my childhood.
Yeah, just enchanted. So I had to call in because I thought, wow, I just saw that this morning. And, yeah, I loved it. Just loved it. Yeah.
Thank you, Pat. Harry the Dirty Dog. That one might be hard to get your hands on because that's from a long time back, but it's probably still out there. Let's talk about some books for middle grade readers. How can you tell if a child in your life is a middle grade reader?
Well, they're probably somewhere between third grade and seventh grade, I'd say. If you can talk to five different educators and they'll give you five different answers, but that's a rough. I think we said 8 to 12 on our list. So
okay, so the first one up is My Antarctica.
Yeah,
true adventures in the land of mummified seals, space robots, and so much more.
Yeah, it's really great. First, it's very, very visually dynamic, but the narrative is an account of the author, Jean Neary's 7-week adventure to Antarctica when he received a National Science Foundation Artists and Writers Grant to travel there. So it's absolutely captivating as he describes both the place, the sort of the phenomena of that environment, the animals, the history of exploration there, but also the many, many scientists and engineers and other people that he's meeting and the work that they're doing, conducting experiments about the Earth in the past and the Earth today, and even outer space is being studied in Antarctica. So there's lots of fascinating information and facts and lists of what he observed. Those are really entertaining. Things like things you will and won't find in Antarctica, vehicles of Antarctica, uniforms of Antarctica, toilets of Antarctica, really. So much to look at, so much to absorb. And he's somebody who feels really strongly that he wanted to be able to talk about this place in a way that would make it accessible to kids.
And the UW-Madison actually is doing some of that space research in Antarctica. So that's pretty cool as well. Well, there's one here that I liked a lot. The author made poems in comic format, and the book title is Poetry Comics. Isn't it, Tessa?
Yes, it is. And this ties into one of the trends that Megan was talking about at the start of the show. With the graphic novel format, this is telling you right in the title that there are comic-style illustrations throughout this text. And yes, it's all beautiful. Elegant, simple poetry for young readers. The format of this whole volume is organized around the four seasons, and many of the poems are very short, sometimes all within one page spread or across a couple of pages, with really familiar scenes and subjects like swimming, going back to school, the first snowfall, and then some really delightful child-centered unexpected moments of reflection or fresh observation or just wondering and curiosity. The same two children are throughout the entire volume, so it really does feel like you're with two characters throughout four different seasons, but it can be really read in bits and pieces as well. There's topics also about what it's like to be a poet and how to refine your work and what does that look like. In really simple text and simple illustrations, I think this is a great book for someone who perhaps wants to give a gift introducing a young person to poetry.
Yeah.
Knowing that they can be hip on the graphic novel thing. You know, sharing that and their love of poetry. And I think young readers, especially those who maybe don't want to invest in a big cover-to-cover chapter book or do just want to find some play between concepts and illustrations, there's a lot for a range of readers in poetry comics.
Our caller earlier mentioned a book from the 1950s about a dog, and you've got one that's kind of up to date, right up to the minute practically. They're All of the Best Dogs by Emily Jenkins.
We do. This is a relatively short and really, really entertaining novel that features four sixth graders, two adults, and six, or is it seven, and that's a little mystery in the story, dogs that all live in the same Brooklyn neighborhood. So each of the kids and both of the adults are dealing with some kind of transition or change or upset. And their dogs, which are their pets, obviously offer comfort, but also a lot of comic relief. For example, Lottie and Grover are a pair of jealous terriers that are very upset at the arrival of their owner's niece because they are no longer the center of their owner's attention. So it really deftly balances the perspective of the humans that are dealing with anxiety or change or uncertainty or the challenges and rewards of friendship with sometimes hilarious dog thoughts and commentary. I would call it a waggish tale.
All right, Megan, I'll give you that one. We've got a lot of kids that are interested in sports, and We Are Big Time by Hannah Kahn is a story for sports lovers, if I'm not mistaken, Tessa.
That's right. And this is also a story that has a Wisconsin connection. We meet Aaliyah, who moves with her family from Tampa to Milwaukee, where everything feels really different and disorienting, especially the weather and climate. Aaliyah goes to an Islamic high school where she joins the girls' basketball team because she played at her old school and she thinks that this might be a great way for her to settle in. However, her new team is just really struggling to score or play together as a team. So the new coach sees Aaliyah's skill and experience and appoints her and a senior as the co-captains as a way to kind of bridge the old and new. And this really brings in some tension with the team.
Sure.
As it would. But really, they find a way together to kind of navigate how to reform themselves as a team, and they are getting some attention because they're now really starting to improve. But unfortunately, a lot of the attention is coming because they are an Islamic team and they play with headscarves, and all the attention is about that. So they're getting press and comments, and the girls are trying to find a way, both individually and as a team, to figure out how to respond to that, to say, this is about us playing a sport and how our team is doing. It shouldn't matter about our religion and what we wear to play the sport. So there's a lot to navigate there. Of course, it's a new school story. It has that Wisconsin connection. But it's just a fabulous sports story. It is also a graphic novel. And so I think this one of the successes of the writing is how you can take the dynamic action in a sporting event and make it come to life and keep the action going panel by panel in a way that I think comes differently when you are using just text to express the progress in a game. So I think it's really successful, really relatable on a lot of different levels, and just ultimately a great success story.
We Are Big Time. We need to get tween and teen readers in. One book I want to mention off your list is a great goal, The Epic Battle of Equal Pay for in Women's Soccer.
It's a really nice follow-up to the book Tessa just did.
Yeah.
This is an informational book, and it's a riveting, and I will tell you, sometimes infuriating account of the efforts of the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team to achieve equal pay and equal working conditions. And this is a fight that took them over 30 years. It began right at the beginning of the 1990s, and they finally reached an agreement that really significantly achieved what they wanted in 2022. And so this is just a really well-done, fast-paced informational book that looks at individual player stories, as well as the efforts of the team and the way they were unified as a team across the years doing this was really inspiring. But the author also puts it in the context of the larger issue of equal pay for women, both here in the United States and globally.
And in 30 seconds, Maid and the Crocodile. That's another.
Oh, I'm going to try to be really fast on this one. Some listeners might be familiar with Jordan Ufoko, who wrote a really popular series called The Ray Bearer. And this story is adjacent. It's also set in this West African-inspired setting. In this story, we meet Small Shade, who is an orphan who is aged out of the care system. And she's determined to find a place for herself in society where she has two strikes against her in this realistic fantasy world. She uses a cane to walk because of an accident that crushed her foot when she was a child laborer. And she also has mottled skin, which we would see as vitiligo. And those are two impediments for her to exist in society. But through an incident with a magical crocodile and some new friends, she's able to really find a place for herself. And it's really a love story.
And on that note, we didn't get to all the books, but I tell you what, the list is up on our page, or will be up on our page, talk@WPR.org/Larry, or I think just WPR.org/Larry. And you're going to find the list. Megan and Tessa, we got to have you back. And we'll talk about summer reading for the child.
Gladly.
We'll do that.
We're always happy to talk about great books for young readers.
Megan Schliesman and Tessa Michelson-Schmidt from the Cooperative Children's Book Center at the UW-Madison. Thanks to them, and thanks to you for listening. Go to our site, talk@WPR.org/Larry, and you're going to find all the selections from both segments.